The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 204.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone back to the Rebel Capitalist Show. My good buddy from down under, from Oz, Martin North. Martin, welcome back to the show, my friend.
Hi, George. How are you going? It's a long time no speak, but boy, a lot has changed in the last couple of months, hasn't it?
I don't know. Has anything changed in the Australian housing market other than it's
just a bit. You know, I've said to you, I think before, that the Australian economy is house and holes, right? Houses and holes. So basically, right. It's all about the housing sector and it's all about mining, right? Well, over the last few months with the COVID, the government threw billions and billions of dollars at the construction sector through billions and billions of bribes at first-time buyers. And guess what? Property prices are on the rise again. And we've already got very high property prices, very high debt, and they're throwing yet more of this on the fire. And by the way, they're also releasing some of the lending standards to make it even easier to borrow, despite the very high debt. So the government is basically betting on housing to get us out of this hole.
So what are they doing specifically? So you talked about they're lowering lending standards. And yep. What else are they doing? I mean, at what point do you not need income at all to buy $1 million? I mean, that's pretty much the end game here, right? That they just say you don't need to pay us anything, no down payment, no monthly payments, just put your name on the title. I mean, I don't get it.
It really is quite interesting. There was a report that the Reserve Bank published about, I think, 3 years ago, which said that if interest rates drop 100 basis points, home prices would rise by 30% over the following 3 years, all else being equal, right? Mm. And in their model, they don't actually include credit or credit repayments. They don't think that's an important part of the housing cycle, right? So, and of course, rates have come down. So that means that people are able to borrow somewhat more. The responsible lending standards were put in after the global financial crisis. So basically, there's a thing that says lenders need to take account of people's personal situation and make sure that the loan that is being made is not, quote, acceptable. So responsible lending, not suitable, is the sort of thing, right? So that's being removed. And basically what's going to happen now is that the only thing that's going to be important is that the systemic structural risks of the bank should be taken into account, right? So that basically means, well, yeah, pretty much, you know, there's no limits to what you can borrow. And in fact, I'm seeing at the moment in my data, people getting 8 times income ratios on loans now. 8 times. I mean, that was, you know, wacky.
Let's think through that. 8 times. So yeah. What does that mean? If you're making
if your income was 100,000, then 8 times means you can get 800,000 by way of a mortgage, right?
So by that's way of a mortgage.
And of course, their argument is, well, rates are really, really low, so therefore this isn't a problem because repayments, you know, are somewhat lower on the interest. But of course, you've still got to pay the capital back. And so the thing that I come back to, George, and this is sort of a more general point, you know, I think that the financial system has now basically boiled back households and individuals into effectively a series of cash flows, right? And they expect people to continue to pay cash flows, you know, right through their life. And of course, that means that they can continue to make profits. But, you know, the impost on people over their life through this repayment cycle just gets bigger and bigger, longer and longer. And people are talking about longer loans and they're talking about, bigger loans. Interestingly, though, property investors aren't coming to the party. So a lot of this is now people buying houses. And what's happening, the other trend, which is also going at exactly the same time, is that people are moving out from the cities. So they're moving into the regional areas, they're moving away from the big centers because I guess the virus and things. And so what we're seeing is a huge skew in terms of demand for houses and specifically away from the urban centers. It's really a massive, amazing.
Prices going down in the urban centers like we're seeing in areas here in the US?
So what we're seeing is that unit prices, so particularly in the high-rise sector, are down 20 to 25% now in some areas. And then they're still throwing more investments at more high-rises. But the homeland packages, which are the things on the urban fringe, you know, you basically find a bit of farmland, convert it into building plots, and then you sell them off, right? The government threw money at those and encouraged people to go buy them. So you could get, for example, in Western Australia, you could get $55,000 from the state and federal government to support a homeland package. There was a huge rise in the number of those being sold over the last quarter. And in fact, in the latest price statistics, the CPI, they actually called out homeland packages as being one of the impacts to price increases, because what happened was that all of the builders put the homeland package prices up by more than the government stimulus, right? So this is a great example of a net sum game. So what you've got in the situation here is you've got this massive buildup now of demand for construction for these homeland packages. And in fact, they can't get the building materials, neither can they get the workers, because it's just too difficult to do. So we've created this amazing mess over there. And then the other thing, just to sort of complete the story, they also allowed people to withdraw from their pensions, the superannuation. So you could withdraw $10,000 last year, financial year, and $10,000 this year, $20,000, right? And my research says that about 21, 22% of first-time buyers who've come into the market use those superannuation balances as part of the deposit to go and basically buy that property. So this whole thing is stoking the property sector, right? And remember what I said, we've got very high debt already and very high property prices, and yet we're still going even higher.
Yeah, but it's so, Mike, when you're saying that, what I was thinking is, like, there's only, I mean, let's say 25 million people in Australia. At what point does everyone own a home? And there's no, like, if everyone owns a home, like, how can you sell any more homes unless you're moving? But then you're talking about a rotation of population out of the urban areas into, let's just call it, the more rural areas, the more suburban areas. So, but still, doesn't that cause a big problem for the banks? Because all those people that are leaving the urban areas, I mean, they have mortgages. And are they, I guess, if they're selling, couldn't they, or aren't they selling at a loss because they're upside down? They don't have any equity? Or are we at the point yet where they're not, where there's still some equity buffer there?
Now, the equity is still there. For most owner occupiers, it's not a problem, but for the property investors, that's where the real action is, because a few things have happened there. In the investment sector, there was a massive run-up of investment properties over the last few years. And the government gave huge stimulus again through tax breaks. A lot of that went to property investors who were building in the high-rise sector. A lot of that was actually foreign buyers as well. And, you know, they came in. A lot of the high-rise was also for students and short-term accommodation. And of course, we haven't got any students, international students, come back now as well. We've got no international visitors buying. And so effectively in the urban centers, the vacancy rates in high-rise apartments close into the center of towns, and in fact even further out, has gone through the roof. The rents have dropped by 20 to 30% if you can get anybody to rent the properties at all. So that's the thing. The people who are moving are the people who already have property and are just trading up, because basically, you know, they've got equity in their existing property. They can get a bigger loan now, and then they can buy something bigger. More people are working from home, so they want a bigger property. So all of that's in play. So what I think's going on is we're seeing this massive sort of bifurcation between units and houses, right? And between the main urban centers, where units are really, on the nose, and out in the sticks. And interestingly, there's been more planning releases recently of more planned high-rise development, right? So they're still sort of wanting to put more of these high-rise things up. The other observation, George, and this is something which I've been looking at quite recently, is in the inner suburban areas, what's happened there in the last few years is a change in the planning rules to allow people to knock down a single house on a block and essentially put up two or three or four townhouses or a low-rise block as well. So we're seeing a massive transformation of our inner suburban areas from relatively leafy green to, again, high concentration areas with a lot of population growth, except there's no population growth now to meet the stuff that's being built. So we've got this massive skew going on. And I just think that nobody's really taking account of, you know, the risks that are involved here, the changes of the character in the places that I'm looking at. And what's interesting is the government 3 or 4 years ago said home prices will never fall under our watch. Well, now they're certainly rising now. The Reserve Bank is saying, well, you know, rates are going to stay low for a long time, so that's not a problem. And the lending standards mean that more people will borrow. So they're just pumping the housing sector to try and actually keep the economy afloat.
So what's happening with nominal GDP there? Not only just the headline number, but here in the United States, as an example, government spending has become an astronomical percentage of overall GDP. And I don't think, you know, that's something that's missed on, if you watch CNBC or Bloomberg, they just say that, oh, you know, if you look at all of 2020, we had a big drop in, call it Q2, but then we rebounded to where GDP only went down by, call it 5 or 6%. But what they omit from that is how much the government had to spend to keep GDP from going down even further. And the government has to take on, let's say, spend $5 trillion or have $5 trillion deficits in the United States. And therefore, what's happening is the government is spending more and more and more, becoming a bigger part of GDP, where the private sector is becoming a decreasing percentage of GDP. So are you guys seeing that happen there in Australia as well?
Well, certainly the government spending has gone through the roof. The expectation now is that government debt will be above $1 trillion, in fact, probably more than that. They've also encouraged the states to borrow big as well. And so, you know, the pile of debt and the ratio of public to private, therefore, has skewed the same way. What I would say, though, is we're still very much supported by the mining sector, and particularly the iron ore price, right? So the iron ore price is extremely high, and that is actually supporting the economy. So effectively, we are still seeing the resource sector and the housing sector basically, you know, ticking along. Government sector investment as a proportion of total GDP, way up. But the GDP that's coming out of the rest of the private sector, and particularly the small business sector, just going through the floor.
You're right.
The overall expectation is that GDP will start to recover. And in fact, the Reserve Bank put out a recent forecast saying, well, you know, the next couple of years, GDP will start to look quite good again. Mind you, once you've dropped substantially, you know, anything up is good, right? But if you look at the mix, it really has become more and more skewed. And the question you've got to ask yourself, George, and this is what I keep scratching my head about, is we've got massive government stimulus still going on at the moment. There's 1.5 to 1.6 million people still receiving direct government support through something called JobKeeper, which basically means they're handing money to businesses to hand on to people to keep them attached to their to their work, even if they're not working at the moment. That 1.6. Now, that's down from more than 3 million, but it's still a big number. We've also got the government handing out money to people who are unemployed at a higher level than previously. Both of those schemes are ratcheting down. They come to an end at the end of March at the moment. So the question is, will they do more beyond that? The other thing that they have been doing is they've been allowing the banks to forego interest and principal repayments on loans or mortgages if people can't afford them. That comes to the end of March as well. So we've got this bit of sort of what happens but after March,
obviously,
right?
The same thing here. Yeah, it's obviously propping up the housing prices. If people don't, or it's impossible for them to have to go through foreclosure if they don't have to make the payments in the first place.
And the other interesting thing there, one of the lenders, mortgage insurers, recently came out and said, we have no idea what the risk profile of the mortgage sector is now.
Right.
Because, you know, there are no defaults. There are also very few bankruptcies because they changed the bankruptcy laws to allow people to trade insolvent. Now, that's beginning to come back now. So I spoke to an insolvency practitioner quite recently who said, you know, it's been very, very quiet for months and months and months. But now we expect a bit of a sort of a rise because businesses are going to come to the end of these support mechanisms at the end of March. You know, there are still lots of business sectors, like in the tourism sector, for example, and in the education sector and in the entertainment sector, who have really not recovered at all from the close downs of last year. And by the way, just to add insult to injury, we've got mini close downs in Melbourne at the moment, again, because of the virus. So, you know, we're not out of the virus cycle. And what I'm also interested in is that everyone is just hanging their hat on the vaccine as the way to solve the problem, right? I'm not sure it's that simple because, of course, the vaccine, well, sure, it'll get rolled out and we haven't yet started rolling any at all here in Australia yet. So that's yet to come. But of course, the issue is, will it deal with transmission and will it deal with the international issue? Because pretty much all of the local cases here now are actually through leakage from international quarantine as people come back into Australia. So unless the global situation improves, I can't see how we can actually possibly insulate ourselves from that. So, you know, I just get a bit frustrated with all of the, the vaccine comes and everything's fine and everything, you know, the GDP is going to bounce back and the government debt will go down and the sun will shine and the birds will sing and, you know, be back to normal. And I'm thinking, yeah, I wonder whether it's going to be that simple.
Yeah, also too, it's wild to me how people think the economy can just have this immediate V-shaped recovery if let's say 20% of the small businesses are no longer in business. Like those, once, it's just bizarre to me that people never put themselves in the position of being a business owner, that you've got X amount of working capital. Let's say it's $100,000. Once that working capital is done and gone, no more jobs, no more business, no more goods, no more services. You're not getting it back. That entrepreneur doesn't go out to the money tree and just pull off another $100,000 and then just take the close sign and flip it to open. And all of a sudden you're off and running the races. It doesn't work that way. Those businesses that close, they're gone forever. They're not coming back. And if they do come back, it's going to take years for other businesses to try to set up shop and save the capital, take the risk to create those jobs, those goods, and those services again. So it's bizarre to me how anyone thinks that, regardless of vaccine or whatever you want to, I mean, if you could just flip a light switch and turn COVID off tomorrow, and you're, there's still not a V-shaped recovery because those businesses are gone. So I don't know. And one thing I wanted to ask you about with Australia is how or is this disproportionately affecting those at the lower end of the economic totem pole? Because you and I can go work from Perth. We can work from anywhere. It doesn't really matter. But that worker that was working at Starbucks or that bartender, that they can't bartend over Zoom. So how does that disproportionately affect them? Are you seeing that in Australia?
Yes, we definitely are. We're seeing, gig workers, part-time workers, people in the hospitality, often part-time workers there. They were the ones that were disproportionately hit. And of course, in the health sector as well, there's a lot of part-time female workers. And in fact, people have been talking about the pink recession, because a lot of the impact was actually amongst female employees rather than necessarily male ones. And as you're right, there is definitely a skew towards particular income bands, and I would say also some social characteristics. You know, recent migrants, for example, who are perhaps working in less savory conditions and have to go to work regardless. And early on, there was a realization from the States that people would, even if they were ill, would go to work, you know. So they actually tried to put in place programs to say, well, we'll pay you some money if you're ill to stay home. They've tried to deal with that. But yeah, it's absolutely right. So it's not equally spread. And interestingly, if you look at the savings ratios, they've gone through the roof for some people who are able to work at home, continue to work, not spend as much because they're not traveling. They've had it quite good. But the reverse is also true. Some of these other groups with less means to start with are much more exposed now. They've got, in some cases, higher debt and less income. Overall incomes are still well down. So absolutely, it's not a uniform impact. It's also not a uniform impact across the country. So for example, if I look at up in Queensland, up in North Queensland, right, they've got issues with international tourists not arriving, right? So the tourist sector's pretty much decimated there. And they've also got problems, for example, with trying to pick fruit, because they used to use international visitors to pick fruit. None of them have come this year. So there's fruit rotting on the tree. So farmers are struggling as well. So wherever you look, you know, above the sort of the hype and the everything's fine, when you come down the notch, you see pockets where there are considerable pressures on individuals. And it tends to be people who are, frankly, less socially advantaged, with less financial assets, and often, frankly, less in focus in terms of the way that this is being presented in the media and in the government. Because obviously the government wants to portray this as, yes, it's an issue, but we're managing it. Everything's going to be fine. And by the way, there'll be probably an election later in the year and they want to get brownie points for that. But the fact is, my surveys say that businesses, small businesses, are definitely struggling. A lot of those individual traders. And interestingly, I mentioned the job keeper. A lot of that went to the big end of town, you know, people with lots and lots of employees. And a lot of them made superior profits and actually paid extra bonuses because of the fact that all that government money went into those top end businesses. Now, my thinking is that was a mistake, a major mistake. A few have paid it back, by the way, but many haven't. Whereas, in fact, the truth is that where the support is still needed and will be needed after March is amongst the small business community, where again and again, I see the same story of, you know, nothing coming in, no chance of business being written. And as you say, no resources to continue to, keep the business afloat. I don't think this is over yet.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
I think one of the mistakes, or one of the many, many mistakes that we made here, in my opinion, is we sent a tremendous amount of, we'll call it support to the individuals, to the point where in 2020, if you look at the average across the United States, incomes were up. I mean, we had arguably depression level unemployment, if you measure it correctly, with the people that are actually not working as opposed to just who haven't looked for work in 4 weeks, or, you know, whatever the measurement is. And so to have just, you know, unemployment that was far higher than the peak of the GFC, and you have to go back to the Great Depression, but yet at the same time, you have personal incomes going up. And then you put the small business owner into a real bind, because now all of a sudden they're competing with the government for workers, because the workers are saying, why on earth should I go back to work in that restaurant or that small business when you're paying me $3,000 a month, when the government is paying me $5,000 a month to sit home and not go to work? And that's, have you guys been seeing that in Australia, or is that just something we're seeing here in the States?
I would say that the level of support, if you're not working, is lower. And in fact, the government has been quite clear here that, you know, the best way of supporting people is to make sure there's a job of some sort, right? So that's why the job keeper was, I think, it was a critical plank. And I'm not saying it shouldn't have happened. I'm just thinking it misfocused. The job seeker stuff, which is essentially if you're unemployed, that's still very low. And they've been ratcheting that payment down and down and down. And in fact, at the end of March, it will be impossibly low. So I'm not sure that we've got a lot of people who are just sitting on their hands thinking, well, this is great. What I would say is in the first sequence of JobKeeper, so that's the one where money was passed through to businesses. In fact, the level at which it was made was quite high. So there were a lot of part-time workers who then got a lot more money than they did when they were working part-time previously, because effectively there was a flat rate. So the scheme was thrown together very quickly, and it was there, of course, you know, as soon as it was able to be made, so just a week or two or three after it was announced. But the impact was that it did skew wages and it did skew the situation. So some people were quite advantageous and actually quite, you know, earned quite a lot more than normal. They sort of tried to tailor that in the second wave. And there are still also some examples of people who basically, some businesses who claimed when they shouldn't have claimed, and that is being swept up a little bit now, but probably not very significantly.
Yeah, you're always going to have the unintended consequences, the moral hazard. Always going to see that.
Yeah. I mean, I think JobKeeper was the right strategy because they needed to act quickly, and because they had these amazing TV footage pieces of lines and lines of people outside the, you know, queuing for unemployment, right? And that was a real shock. I think when people saw those lines and how quickly they developed, the government then responded and reacted because they couldn't allow that to continue. Mm. But the soft underbelly of these programs, I think, is now coming home to roost, which is basically, as I said, you know, top end of town did very well. Thank you very much. A lot of them did well further down, but a lot of small businesses in particular, I think, are the ones that are missing out still. And I think this is going to have an economic consequence, not just for the next year or two, but for 5-10 years.
Yeah. And what's bizarre too is I get the whole work from home thing. Mm. Like, I get, but the wealth of an economy is measured by the amount of goods and services it can produce efficiently. So how many goods and services can you produce from your bedroom? Like, I don't know. I mean, sure, you could do maybe consulting, or you can, if you're a lawyer or an accountant or something like that, you can do that service. But there's a lot of services. And then, of course, 100% of goods. Like, how do you create a good if you're at home in the garage or in your office? It just goes back to this thing that I always get concerned with, that as a society, we have been brainwashed, or we've done it to ourselves, whatever, where we see currency units as wealth instead of the production of goods and services. What do you think about that?
I totally agree. I've said for a long time that the problem we have in Australia is that we are actually narrowing the base of our economy. Right. We've been doing it for the last 2, 3, 4 decades, right? So we have the mining sector, which employs a very small proportion of the population and actually, you know, does ship a lot of stuff overseas, even if it's environmentally not hugely friendly, and that may be an issue down the track. But most of what we do is we import from overseas, and then we have, you know, various service industries locally, and that's about it. Now, if you measure the breadth of our economy, we are something like 40th down the list internationally, below many African countries. So we have a very narrow economic base, and we don't make much. And in fact, over the last 20, 30 years, we've made less and less and less. So for example, I think another oil refinery here is about to close. So we're importing refined petroleum rather than actually creating it here, right? I give the government a kudos here. They actually did inject money to allow CSL to start making the vaccine here locally, because they needed the manufacturing capability. Well, that was a bit unusual. We just don't make much stuff. And the argument always is, well, it can be made cheaper overseas, so we'll just buy it cheap overseas. But of course, there are lots of risks of buying it overseas. More importantly, if an economy effectively gets narrower and narrower and narrower, so basically what you're doing is chasing your tail around housing prices and, you know, mortgages and mortgage lending and houses prices, right? And the resource sector, so going back to my houses and holes, if that's all you got, you have to question what the future economically of the country is going to be.
Yeah, it's far less dynamic. And I mean, what was the problem with Venezuela? They put all their economic eggs in one basket. And if that basket crumbles, then the whole kind of house of cards comes crashing down. What's the trade deficit like in Australia?
Well, we've done pretty well because, of course, we've got that massive import.
For the exports from the mining, right.
Exactly. Right. So we import, you know, huge amounts of money from that. And in fact, imports have been quite low because there's been less demand locally. Obviously, we lost tourism, which was a biggie, and we lost international students, which was a biggie. But net-net, no, the balance of trade ain't being too bad because the iron ore price is, you know, massively higher than anybody's expected.
So, I mean, that could bail you guys out. I mean, let's think this through. If we get stagflation or if we get inflation and we see another run in commodity prices, could that bail you guys out?
Oh, it's certainly a huge proportion of the. Now, of course, the question is who's buying our stuff, right? And the short answer is, well, China's buying our stuff, particularly the iron ore. So let's assume that continues. They have sort of blocked some of the coal exports that we were making previously. And I think our coal is going to be questionable ahead with some of the environmental changes that are going on at the moment. But I think iron ore will be an absolute cornerstone of our economy for quite some time. And as you say, if the price stays high and if, you know, the rest of the world wakes up after COVID and needs to make more stuff, that could keep us afloat for quite some time. But the question is, for how long? You know, at what point does that very narrow basis of our economy also lead to more trouble down the road? One of the issues I keep coming up against when I talk to entrepreneurs is it's very hard to be an entrepreneur in Australia. It's very hard to do new things, to create new businesses, because the support structures and mechanisms that would be needed for that to happen just aren't there. And so quite often, and I've interviewed a few, entrepreneurs create good ideas in Australia and then go to the US to actually make them come true.
Yeah. Because I've done business in Australia. I remember before I retired, and the regulatory environment there was just crippling. I remember I just tried to do a little, I don't know if I told you the story, but I just tried to do something in one of the local malls there. I believe it was in Sydney. And we were doing just this little promotion where we were setting up a table just in the space that we rented in the mall and just some rope and stanchions. And maybe, you know, as people walk by, they come check out the thing that we had at the little booth, right? Our little promotion. Oh my gosh, I had to have like security there. I had to have all these things. I had to go in 3 days in advance and do this. And I had to have this stanchion and these arrows. I'm like, guys, we're just talking about people walking by that are already in the mall. You know, it's just compared to what I would have to do in the United, even in California, I wouldn't have had to do anything like that. I mean, it was just completely ridiculous to anyone that had any type of common sense. But, and that was probably, Martin, that was probably 2010. So I'm assuming it's a lot worse now.
There's plenty of regulation around, and we have state regulation as well as federal regulation, right? And so what you find is that in some areas, if you work across states, then you have multiple regulatory frameworks that you have to actually work against, right? There's no doubt. And I came from the UK where I thought regulation was pretty tight, but in Australia, it's a lot tighter. And a lot of people talk about, quite rightly, all of the red tape that small businesses have to deal with and all the regulation. Now, you know, there are certain things that should be regulated, obviously health and safety and those sorts of things. But I think at the moment, the balance isn't very accurately set. And it is definitely a blocker for innovation and for new things to happen. The other point about that is that it's not just regulation. It is also about, let me say, the psychology of Australia and Australians, right? And that is that, you know, nice sunny days, beaches look good, she'll be right, you know, what's, let's not bother sort of thing. So there's a bit of a, can I put it like this? There's a bit of a lazy streak here in Australia. You know, there's a bit of a, yeah, you know, it's all right. You know, things, go and watch some sport and we'll sit on the beach and everything will be fine. Now that is a bit of a, you know, painting a bit of a picture, which is probably people say, no, that's not right. But there is some of that here. And so I don't see necessarily the hard yards being put in by people who, you know, want to be able to take their ideas and make them come alive. And that's yeah. something else that I see. And then yeah. the third element is that we have this amazing situation where smaller organizations keep getting gobbled up by large organizations. So, for example, we've seen some fintech financial services organizations who were doing really interesting, neat stuff mm-hmm. suddenly gobbled up by the big guys. So the big guys get bigger and bigger and bigger and dominate more and more and more. So all the time, you end up with a small number of very large players who are in themselves very inefficient. And so there's, you know, a level of inefficiency that sort of underpins the way things work.
Yeah, see, I think that goes back to the regulations and the government really stifling the ability for new businesses to come in and compete, because smaller businesses do have a lot of advantages. Yeah. Most people that have never been an entrepreneur don't understand the difference. And, you know, I've run businesses with 5 employees. I've run businesses with over 100 employees. And I can tell you, you can do it, even though you got a lot more capital, a lot more wiggle room at the high end there, you can't maneuver as fast. And there's definitely pros and cons for both sizes. You know, it's like trying to navigate the Titanic compared to a little speedboat. You know, sure, that Titanic, they might have a lot more money, but the speedboat can really change course on a dime. They can go a different direction. And that's a huge, huge advantage and a massive competitive edge. But you know, one thing I wanted to discuss briefly is something I've been thinking through here, and that's that most of these economists that are at the Fed, or I would assume at your central bank, or kind of the central planners, they tend to be very Keynesian. And part of the Keynesian philosophy, and I would argue one of the key components, is animal spirits. So if you do have a downturn, or what they would call a downturn in aggregate demand, so a decrease in aggregate demand, they want the government to come in and spend to bring aggregate demand up to where it was, and just basically buy time for those animal spirits of the entrepreneur to kick in and start creating economic output. And as that economic output increases, then the government spending can decrease. And then you kind of flatten out the boom bust cycle, and you're having a lot more boom, or a lot higher booms and a lot shallower busts. I mean, that's kind of the idea of Keynesian economics. But see, what kind of baffles me is that here in the United States, a lot of those people that would call themselves Keynesians are really, maybe, I'm not going to say politically they're for this or that, I want to put words in their mouth, but I think that they're backing proposals that would decrease animal spirits. And I don't think they're even connecting the dots. Like, if you have all of these regulations, if you're doing all these things that we're talking about here, isn't that decreasing animal spirits to the point where if you decrease it enough, then even based on the textbook analysis of Keynesian economics, it doesn't work? Does that make sense?
Well, it does. And I would say this, that if you're in a situation where nothing can be allowed to fail, and essentially, you know, industries and businesses will get government support to stop them falling over, regardless, then you've actually just taken away one of the fundamental planks, if you like, of the way that economies should work, which is that, yeah, there should be, you know, new things arriving and new right. ideas emerging, but you have to have the capital going to those rather than just supporting the, you know, I keep talking about zombie companies, right? There are companies trading in Australia that shouldn't be trading. There's no doubt about that, right? They're trading with very little ability to create value. They're trading because they've been supported by the government for a long, long time. They've traded because they've got the right political connections.
Right.
And I would argue that what we've lost is, you know, that slightly pure note with regards to how, you know, creative capitalism should work, right? Yeah. Now, I'm not necessarily a supporter of the Keynesian model, because it seems to me that, in fact, too often they support on when things go wrong, but they don't withdraw the support when things go right. They just keep pumping, right? And if you look past the global financial crisis, well, yeah, they supported, but then they went on supporting and are still supporting ever more and ever more and ever more. And more and more of the economy is being owned by, you know, the government, Fed, you know, whatever it is, you know, the bank, the Reserve Bank here, pumping in, doing quantitative easing. And so more and more is being controlled. And the thing that I think we've lost is the fact that you've got to allow the economy to be the economy. You can't try and control it like a sort of a large, you know, electronic game where you twiddle the knobs and you see everything moving around. And if things go slightly, you twiddle them again. That's not the way the economy works.
Right.
And I think there are people in high places who genuinely believe that they understand how all of this works and they can pull the lever a little bit and you'll see the results. Except if you look at the expectations about inflation or growth or wages relative to reality, they've been way off for years, for a decade plus,
I don't think
they know how the economy actually works in practice. And so these theoretical models, I think, have been proven to be wrong. And in the process, what we're doing is we're stopping new business entrepreneurs from coming to the fore, creating new things and taking us into new future areas. And that worries me, because what you end up doing is narrowing and narrowing and narrowing the economy, putting more and more centralized control on the economy, taking away the competitive animal spirit edge, what, you know, whatever you want to talk about, and frankly taking away innovation. And that is, I think, you know, what I'm seeing pretty much everywhere I look.
Yeah, right. I think what it boils down to is it's not just about capitalism, it's about free market capitalism. You've got to have the free market component. If you just have private property, it still doesn't necessarily work. And I think maybe that's what we've lost sight of, not only in the United States, but in Australia as well.
Well, I certainly think that we need to have a different way of thinking about the problem, because just repeating what we've done over the last decade or two and expecting a different outcome is plain dumb.
Yeah, there you go. All right, Martin, for my viewers and listeners who want to find out more about what you do, where can they go?
I've got my YouTube channel called Walk the World, and I do daily shows there about economics and finance. And my blog is digitalfinanceanalytics.com.
All right, my friend, I appreciate your time. Can't wait to do it again.
Enjoyed speaking with you, George. Take care.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.